OYOTU.com.
Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 146 of Sign Language. My apologies for the month-long delay in getting an episode out. I know I said that I would aim to get one out every fortnight, but please allow me to explain. So a fortnight went by after episode 145, and I didn't have something to talk about other than part four of Rob's email, but I didn't have any other stuff at the time, so I thought, oh, I'll just let it go for a week. And then that third week, I honestly did plan to do something, even though I was still struggling for some ideas. But then on the Monday night of that third week, which is actually 2 weeks ago now, this massive storm front hit the east coast of Australia. I actually think we may have been on the tail end of a cyclone. Anyway, it took out our AC power on Monday night, and we didn't get power back until 6:30 on Friday night. It was four whole days without power. To make it even worse, I love camping, but I love to prepare to go camping. To have time to pack all the things that I need and make sure that everything's charged and be ready for the camping experience. But to have it suddenly thrust upon you with no warning and with no expiry date in sight, you know, that was the worst part. Was they were saying, you know, it could be the weekend before you get it back. And then around about Wednesday, they started saying it could be next Tuesday before we get power back on. We're just like, what? Are you serious? So it was one thing to lose AC power, but I'm in one of the few houses in Australia that actually got connected to the NBN, the National Broadband Network, before we had the change of government, who foolishly decided that, no, we're no longer going to run fibre to the home, we're just going to run fibre to the node. My house actually has fiber all the way to the house, which is pretty cool. And the NBN's pretty damn good when it works. The downside of the NBN is that when they connect you to it, they take away the copper phone line, and your phone then plugs into your router, and all your phone calls via landline go voice over IP. So as you can imagine, the moment the AC power goes out, suddenly your modem slash router doesn't work because there's no AC power, hence your phone doesn't work. Nice work, people! So, 4 days, no power. 4 days, no landline phone. To add to the frustration, Optus, who is my mobile phone carrier, during the same storm, lost every single cell phone tower on the southern end of the central coast, which is smack bang where I live, of course. I actually went onto Optus's website and looked at the coverage map, and you could see this entire area of the central coast where every single relay tower of Optus's was out of action. It was showing red on the map. And even though we got power back on Friday night, Optus didn't get their mobile network back up until the Sunday. So basically, we were 6 days without mobile coverage. So for those 4 days, from Monday night to Friday night, there was nothing. There was nothing, right? No power, no phone of any description, no internet, no way to send a text to anybody, nothing. It was like living in the dark ages for 4 days. So as you can imagine, you know, that completely threw all plans and hopes of doing a podcast that week straight out the window. And then this week has just got away from me because there were, you know, other jobs that I do for people outside of my 40-hour a week job, which came in last week, although I didn't know it at the time because I couldn't access email or anything like that. And so all of that stuff I've been trying to get through this week. So now it is 10 to 11 on Sunday morning, and if I'm going to get this podcast out by midday, that means I've got about 70 minutes to not only record, but to then edit, mix, render, MP3 metadata, tag, upload, write show notes, hit publish. So I'm going to have to scoot. So what have I got to cover? Okay, I did want to get to part four of Rob's epic email because I feel like I've been sitting on that for a little while. But before I do that, I was talking about, in the last couple of episodes, my fascination with Egypt and the pyramids and whatever. And I started looking into the actual dimensions of the King's Chamber inside the Pyramid of Cheops. And although I haven't kept the numbers right in front of me, I've got some links which will be in the show notes. And what really amazed me was that the length of the room was exactly double the width of the room. So in other words, the floor plan is a perfect 2-to-1 aspect ratio. And the height of the room was quite astronomical. It was like 5 meters from floor to ceiling. And so I got really interested by the dimensions of it, and I started wondering what would be the resonant frequency of the room, you know, because based on the formula of C equals F lambda, where C is the speed of sound, F is frequency, lambda is the wavelength of a sound wave in meters, you can calculate the resonant frequency of any space, right? And if you remember your high school algebra, you can then isolate either F or lambda by dividing by C, right? So if you want frequency, it's C over lambda. If you want lambda, then it's C over F. Is that right? Divide both. Yeah, that's right. So that got me really interested in you know, what would be the resonant frequency of the King's Chamber. And when I started doing the maths, I realized that the resonant frequency across the width of the chamber, which was around about 5 meters, worked out to something like about 65 hertz. And then I got really excited because I looked at a chart of musical pitches and found that 65 hertz was really, really, really super close to, I think it was C2 on a piano. And so then I started thinking, whoa, this is really trippy because the ancient Egyptians obviously understood musical theory, you know, because they blah, blah, blah. And obviously the length of the room being double that would have halved that. So that would have meant that the resonant frequency of the length of the King's Chamber would have been equal to C1 on a piano. But then I shot myself in the foot. But when I came to the realization that, oh, hang on, we haven't always assumed A to be 440. And so then, you know, then I sort of went back and looked and found that we only standardized 440 hertz as A4 around about, was it 1932 or something like that? It was early in the 20th century. So it's quite a recent development that we moved to 440 hertz. Prior to that, it was all 432. And so when I then recalculated, you know, based on, I mean, and again, it's only an assumption that the ancient Egyptians were using 432 as a reference for A, and they wouldn't have called it A, and who knows what they were using. The whole argument went out the window. So, but I do still find the whole thing very fascinating. You know, the construction of the pyramids and just, yeah, the acoustic nature of it excites me, and it's on my bucket list of things to visit. So anyway, there'll be a couple of links in the show notes for anyone who wants to explore that stuff. All right. Before I get on to part four of Rob's epic email, I had the same thought, and Rob had and came to the same thought as well, and I can't remember if I actually mentioned this in the last episode where we were talking about the, you know, quote-unquote pirating of the Coca-Cola cans. I think it came to me after I'd recorded that the difference between that and the music is that your can of Coke is a one-time use product, where music obviously is designed to be enjoyed over and over and over, and hence why, you know, there's not quite the correlation that there might have appeared to be initially. And Rob replied to me and said pretty much the same thing. Okay, so on to part four of Rob's original epic email. This was called Zombie Binaural Ears and ASMR Fetish Tribes. It appears binaural audio still seems to surprise people who just found out about it, and they managed to get thousands of views on a topic that certain communities may find laughably old and obvious. I'm talking about how a website like The Verge can surprise their audience with something we tend to use every day. Two ears. If you watch the video, please do elaborate on the mistakes they made. Okay, I'll just jump in there, Rob. I did watch all 7 minutes of the video, and I quite enjoyed it. And I thought it was a good introduction for people who are new to it. For anyone who's not encountered binaural audio, I thought they did a reasonable, you know, layman's job of explaining it to the masses. And let's face it, it's The Verge. It's not, you know, the Audio Engineering Society of New York. So, you know, let's cut them a little bit of slack. you know. As for the mistakes, nothing really. I mean, I'm not a binaural fetishist, so, you know, maybe you're aware of mistakes in there that I was not aware of. One thing Rob did point out was that he thought that the microphones in the 3DO binaural dummy head that they were using during the production of this video, Rob felt that the microphones were sticking a bit too far out of the dummy ears. Now, I will include Rob's screen capture as a photograph in the show notes, where he circled the, you know, the microphone, not that you really needed it circled. It didn't strike me as being protruding excessively out of the ear. I would imagine, Rob, and like I said, I'm not an expert in binaural, but I would imagine that, you know, the way a dummy head is constructed is that you use omnidirectional microphones inside, you know, a head-shaped enclosure with, you know, dummy ears on the side like the 3DO microphone had. And the sound arrives, you know, on either side of the head at different times and blah, 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 and replicates all of the acoustic cues, phase cues, timing cues, frequency cues, amplitude cues that we rely on every single day with our hearing to recreate that binaural playback effect. And I would imagine that the microphones would need to be a little closer to the surface of the head than our eardrum is. Like I said, I don't know enough about it, but I would imagine that they do need to be a little further out than where the eardrum would sit inside the head of a human being. If you've got more to add to that, by all means, mate, send me an email. Quite happy to discuss. Okay, so on with Rob's treatise.
What surprised me is how the toy on stage effect is easily spotted when we see what people do with a cool piece of gear, and they get so incredibly fascinated by it, they expect it to replace their creativity. It just becomes a glorified gimmick. It should complement the performance, not take center stage. They almost did that with the 3DO Free Space binaural microphone. They let it take center stage. Yes, somehow that was the point, but still was too obvious. The gear itself is nice. And it does make sense the gear modifies the audio as it follows the shape of the human ear has evolved into. However, for that very reason, I'm very skeptical their gear was accurate as the microphone seems to be sticking out, which would be inaccurate as humans do not have their inner ears exposed. If we were going to mention that the emulation of the anatomy of the human ear was that important, it would stand to reason that the inner ear would be inside the plastic ears, not hanging outside. I'm very skeptical the model they were using was anatomically correct. What do you think, Bruce? Would it matter if the mic is hanging outside, battered zombie style?
Well, I just answered that a minute ago. Sorry, I sort of jumped ahead of myself a little bit there, Rob. My apologies. Yeah, I think I've addressed that. Okay, moving on.
Inaccuracies aside, after looking at the gear itself, I find the audio samples are interesting, and even more interesting is that they seem to have a thriving community of users in the Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response, ASMR, community. Yes, they do exist, man. The internet hosts all kinds of weird tribes. Now, the reason I bring this up is the unusual variety of audio fetishes they produce and how they even derive an income from it.
And Rob's included a link to a YouTube channel of a girl who just sits in her bedroom doing these binaural things that are meant to make you sleepy and all sorts of stuff. So anyway, I'll put that link in the show notes.
Contrary to their claims, I happen to fail to relax or get into a mood with their recordings. I have 14 terabytes of proper porn for that. But what I find interesting is how their community may influence others, such as video games. Audio in video games is, in and of itself, a rich, rich topic I will elaborate upon later on. Or movies. The main problem I find is this. Let's assume you recorded everything as nicely as possible with your white, fetishy, rubbery ears. You then painstakingly mix it down for weeks and release it only to find out the audience is all fragmented and has no way of properly experiencing a realistic version of your audio because most headphones and earbuds just suck. That is, in my humble opinion, the main problem of exotically recorded audio, because the author has no real control over the way the audience will listen to it. As usual, I'd like to hear your feedback on these musings.
Okay, I'm going to jump right in there at the tail end. As for the way the audio is mixed and mastered and presented to the masses, mate, it's always going to be a given that even though insert name of famous favorite Hollywood movie director here sits in a fantastic mix-oriented theater, like the one I was fortunate enough to be shown through in Hollywood, and he gets to watch the final print of the film, and he's listening to all the stems of the different audio Pro Tools rigs, you know, because they bring in a Pro Tools rig for the music scoring and another one for the ADR and another one for the sound effects and another one for the Foley and another one for the original music score. And all these things are coming up through, you know, hundreds of faders on an analog console. Yeah, he gets to hear all that and he gets to see it in a pristine environment, you know, this mix theater. And they mix it in 5.1, and I'm sure it's absolutely rocking his world while he's sitting there in that theater mixing that movie. But the reality is that thing's going to get, you know, mixed to, there's going to be a stereo down mix for TV distribution after the theater run is finished, right? Where it's only going to get broadcast in stereo. Then you've got every man and his dog who's sitting on public transport anywhere in the world who's watching this crap on their iPhone, or worse, if there's anything worse than an iPhone. But my point is, you know, people are consuming this product on all kinds of devices. And as you said, yeah, many of them are using headphones and earbuds. And God forbid, some people actually set their phone on a little 45-degree stand on the desk in front of them and think that the quote-unquote stereo speakers that are built into their phone are giving them the full stereo experience. Like, what? Really? This movie was mixed in 5.1 in a theater that probably cost, you know, $10,000 a day to hire to do the mix, and you're playing it back on these two bloody, you know, tenth of an inch speakers that are embedded at either end of a 5-inch mobile device. Like, rah, really? So those are my thoughts. Just off topic. Well, on topic, off topic. You mentioned earbuds. I thought I had to mention that just this week, I've been out and purchased not my second, not my third, but my fourth set of Sennheiser CX300s. I've been using these earbuds for pretty much close on 10 years now, and they rock my world. And every time I kill a set, and it's not that I'm necessarily hard on my earbuds, it's just, you know, particularly sticking them in my ears and then pulling a motorcycle helmet on over the top, that kind of, you know, creates a bit of friction on the cabling, and, you know, then pulling the helmet off, you know, does the same thing in reverse. And so, you know, they take a fair bit of a beating from me, you know. And I am using them 5 days a week without fail, you know. Well, the weeks I'm at work, put it that way. And so, yeah, I get about, you know, 2.5-3 years out of a pair of these things. And every time I kill a set, I think to myself, oh, I really should look around and see what else is on the market. The horrible thing about trying to buy earbuds from a retail perspective is there's nowhere you can go and trial them all. You know, if you want headphones, Yep, knock yourself out. Walk into any big box electronics store. They've got them all plugged in, set up, and you've got, you know, the little switch box where you can switch between which headphones you want to listen to, or, you know, which audio source you want to hear, so you can listen to the music you want to listen to. But earbuds, no. You might contaminate them with your earwax. Okay, yeah, I kind of get it. There's a little bit of a hygiene issue there, but really? Has anyone ever died by getting somebody else's earwax in their ears? I don't know. Okay, maybe it's a bit tacky, but I find it frustrating from a retail end user perspective that there is nowhere you can go and try different earbuds to see what they sound like, what they feel like, how they, you know, the whole user experience. Just about every other device you will ever purchase, well, with the exception of maybe condoms, you just don't get to try them out first. I mean, everything else you can try out first, but these you can't. So, you know, I find that weird. You know, I mean, those little, the little rubber bits that go on the end of the earbuds, right? I mean, they cannot be that expensive to produce, surely, right? So why can the manufacturers not provide thousands of those in different sizes to a store and say, whenever anyone wants to listen to our earbuds, now not the competitors, we don't give a crap about them, but if anyone wants to listen to our earbuds and compare all of the products in our range, you crack open a pair and you give them a pair of those little rubber grommets that fit their ears, and you let them listen to all the earbuds they want to listen to, and when they're done, you give them those little rubber grommets and you tell them they can chuck them in the bin on the way out, right? I mean, seriously, those things can't be expensive. And that would at least allow the end user to hear what every set of earbuds sounds like. So this week I go into JB Hi-Fi here at Macquarie Shopping Centre in Sydney, and I noticed that Sennheiser have a new range out on the market called the CX 1.0, CX 2.0, CX 3.0, yada, 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 yada. So I said to the guy, who's the most knowledgeable in the store when it comes to earbuds? And he said, oh, that'd probably be me. And I went, okay, sweet. I said, look, these are my CX300s I've got hanging around my ears. They're on their way out. It's time for me to get a new set. What's the difference between this CX 3.0, which was retailing for $89 a pair, versus the CX300s, which I know and love, this is my third set, and they're $75 a pair? And he said, look, you know, they're pretty much of a muchness. He said the difference is the CX300s have an asymmetrical cable, so the idea is that you put the long cable around the back of your neck and you have the cable come down over your shoulder and down the left side of your chest. I went, yeah, familiar with that. He said where the CX 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, etc., they have a symmetrical cable, so they just hang from both ears down in front of you. I went, okay, anything else? We looked at the specs. The sensitivity was a little bit less. Frequency response was supposedly better. And I went, yeah, okay, well, they're obviously newer technology because it's a newer product to market, so what the hell? I'll give them a go. So buy them, walk out of the store, go and find a seat, sit down, take them out of the box as delicately as I possibly could, plugged them in. 5 seconds later, I'm like, nah, rip them out, wrap them back up as neatly as possible, put them back in the box, went back to the store, said to the first guy I came across, I said, look, mate, I was here 5 minutes ago. I said, I bought these. I said, I've had to listen to them for 20 seconds. I hate them. They're not as good as the CX300s. I want the CX300s. He went, oh, geez. He said, it's really dicey with earbuds, you know, the hygiene issue. And I'm like, yeah, but dude, look, seriously, like, I had them in my ears for, you know, 15, 20 seconds at most. He went, well, he said, you know, looks like the box hasn't been opened. So he said, just grab the CX300s and go up to the counter and tell them you want to swap them. I went, okay. So I grabbed the CX300s, went up to the counter, told the guy the story. He looks at the box and goes, oh, yeah, they haven't been opened. That's fine. And promptly swaps them over. I wasn't going to correct him. So, yeah, so now I'm on my fourth set of CX300s and absolutely loving them, as usual. But, yeah, I just find it frustrating that you cannot go into a store and try out all the different earbuds that are around. Because I keep reading things on the net about, you know, earbuds are very subjective, right? Everyone's got their personal favorite. I keep reading really good things about some of the Shure products and some of the Etymotics, and yeah, there's a couple other brands that I've read really good things about. And it's like, yeah, but I'm not going to sink $150 on a pair of earbuds until I've heard them. You know, I want to know what I'm getting myself into. Anyway, so sorry for that little diatribe. Coming back to Rob's binaural thing. Yeah, look, you know, I think it's great that we can experience binaural recording and playback by listening on headphones. And for anyone who hasn't ever checked out binaural recording, please do yourself a favor, go to YouTube and search some stuff. It's interesting. The very first time you hear it, it'll freak you out. As for the adoption of binaural audio for movies, I see two major production stumbling blocks here. And I'm fairly certain I might have addressed this in the past on another episode of Sign Language, but forgive me if I have. Twofold problem. One, the post-production and mixing aspect of working with binaural sounds. And two, the delivery to consumer experience, and particularly in theatres. All right, now I'll come back to that. Okay, so point one, the production and mixing side of things. If we were to assume that, you know, picture a scene on a movie screen where you've got a fight scene happening right in front of the camera, and there are other things in the background which are moving, right? You're going to have to record every one of those sounds in a binaural format, but you've got to simulate the camera moves relative to the position in three-dimensional space of the noise-generating source, whatever it is, whether it's a car going past or an airplane flying overhead. You have to move those microphones as you're recording those sounds in sync with the movement of the camera, right? And how does the focal length of the camera alter the stereo placement of that sound if you're trying to do it as a binaural source? Now, that's one part of the problem, is how you mic all of those sounds so that they stay in the right space relative to what the camera moves are doing. That's one part of it. The second part then is, how do you mix all of these binaural recordings together? Yes, I get that they're just stereo recordings, and therefore they can be mixed in a multi-track just like any other piece of audio. But do all the phase relationships, amplitude relationships, etc., translate properly when you start adding multiple binaural recordings together? And that's not a question I can answer. I don't know. I haven't done any experiments. And like I said, I'm not particularly experienced with binaural recording. I've experienced it. That's about the limit of my experience, you know. So there's those two aspects, is how you record all that stuff so that it's properly placed in the binaural landscape so that it stays in relation to any moves of the camera. And let's face it, in a fast action camera, you know, high action movie, you know, camera moves can be rapid, and, you know, the cuts between scenes are very rapid. So imagine how disconcerting that would be as well. You know, if you know, your camera move suddenly goes from position A to position B, which is, you know, 120 degrees around the arc, you know, of whatever the subject matter is, you know, let's say a hypothetical fight scene. Imagine the audio cut then, you know, because everything, like what's in the middle of the camera view, the fight scene, that's going to stay where it is, but all of that other surround stuff is suddenly going to jump from what felt like dead in front but further away. It's suddenly now off to one side and three quarters behind me, and yeah, wow, the mind boggles. But I have no doubt technology will get there and it won't be long before the audio does get to that level of realism. And it will be as massive a revelation to the cinema experience as colour was when it was first introduced, right? Okay, so on to point B, delivery to the consumer in theatre, right? We have to remember that, certainly for the time being, Hollywood recoups the majority of its expenditure to make a big budget blockbuster through ticket sales in cinemas. Now, the whole cinema experience at the moment is based on the idea of nice big screen, awesome surround sound playback system, and, you know, comfy seats and expensive popcorn and soft drink, right? That's the cinema experience. The problem is, if you mixed all that audio in a binaural format, I don't think you could then get away with playing it through loudspeakers in the cinema, because suddenly you've changed the distance relationship between, you know, the guy who's three seats away from the wall on one side of the cinema is not getting the same experience as the guy who's sitting right in the middle of the center line of the cinema. So I see that as being a bit of an impediment. And, you know, obviously we don't want people sitting in cinemas with earbuds or headphones because, you know, as much as I, for one, hate people talking in the cinema, people do like to talk to each other in the middle of a movie. And if you've got earbuds in, you can't be talking to the person next to you. And if you've got to take an earbud out so you can hear what they're saying to you, suddenly you're missing part of the experience of the movie. Yeah. You see where this is going, right? Anyway, so those are my thoughts. Rob, for whatever they're worth, take from that what you will. Over the last month, one of the things that I did come across was a fantastic analysis and testing of a whole range of drum overhead microphone techniques. So completely shifting gear to music recording here. And this was on recordinghacks.com. I'm not going to go through, you know, everything that was in it because it's now 20 past 11. I've got 40 minutes to finish recording this and then mix it and blah, blah, blah. So I'm just going to throw the link in the show notes for anyone that wants to go and check it out. If you are interested in recording music as I am, this was a really comprehensive analysis of all the different stereo miking techniques and how they affected just, you know, this guy playing drums. And the guy who did it was the guy who was playing the drums, and he's also the audio engineer. So he'd set up each of these different stereo miking techniques, and then he would sit down and play his drum kit. And he's got all of the files linked on his website, so on the Recording Hacks post, so you can listen to all of these different stereo miking techniques. I thought it was really, really interesting. Rob Bettler also sent me a link to, and I had seen this myself, I think it came up on my Facebook feed somewhere, about a university crew somewhere, I can't remember where it was, pretty sure it was the US, extinguishing fire with sound. Now, obviously, this would use low-frequency signals, which would cause massive excursion of a speaker cone. And obviously that would, you know, vibrate air quite frantically. Yeah, interested to see where this goes. I'm not sure how effective it would be. Certainly it would make less mess than soaking everything in water. Although, you know, you could argue that once something's on fire, does it really matter if it then gets wet? I think the damage has already been done. But it was certainly interesting to watch. These guys had this, you know, portable sound generator and, you know, essentially a subwoofer on a stick that would put out fire. So definitely check that one out. And the last thing I want to finish on is the Bill Gates quote, which I will confess I have, you know, mentioned this myself in the past about how allegedly in 1982 Bill Gates said no one will ever need more than 64K of memory or whatever it was. Interestingly, on wikiquote.org, there is a quote from Bill Gates who says,
"I've said some stupid things and some wrong things, but not that. No one involved in computers would ever say that a certain amount of memory is enough for all time." I keep bumping into that silly quotation attributed to me that says 640K of memory is enough. There's never a citation. The quotation just floats like a rumor, repeated again and again.
So there you go. That's the word from Bill. Apparently, he didn't ever say that. So, and I'm kind of relieved to hear that because you would like to believe that somebody in his position would know that you would never make a comment like that. It would be like saying 5.1 is all we ever need for audio reproduction. You know, or binaural is all we're ever going to need. You know, there is always going to be some sort of technological improvement. Yeah, we're never going to reach a point where everything has been done. So, anyway, I will finish it here. It is almost 11:30. I've got half an hour to get this thing out the door. So, good to get an episode out. And any comments, questions, feedback, please drop me an email, studio@audio2u.com. And until I speak with you next, take care.
Sign Language.
Another audio2u.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out
signlanguagepodcast.com
or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email studio@audio2u.com.